Hey, Bill and Gunner, welcome to Blackwell Tribal Edition. Murumu here with you today, and we've got Ganyara in the studio. Bumi and Dirilum are one's intercontinental, and the other one's looking on country somewhere doing some work out there. And if you're listening, Bumi, we love you and we miss you. And we love having you on here, so we'll catch up next week and see what's going on there. Ganyara, it's been some interesting times. Recently, the Yidinji delegation travelled down to the Birriggubba Nation to celebrate its two-year milestone, its National Day, where they formed government down there and things like that. And we're going to find out that it's happening more frequently now, where other nations, I know the Kabi Kabi are looking at doing something like that as well, because the Australian situation is looking bleaker by the day. And we're going to go to some recordings. Pauline Hanson has come out again slamming cultural heritage and saying that these things impact on Australians' life and we're all Australians, X, Y, Z. And so let's have a listen to that one first before we go anywhere.
But I want to go to another person sitting in the path of this cyclone now, and that is One Nation leader Pauline Hanson. Again, not on the coast, inland at Scenic Rim. I've got to get your thoughts on this latest Indigenous heritage claim, the one on Mount Panorama at Bathurst. As I said last night, that's a sacred site for every petrol head in the country. This is just getting ridiculous, isn't it? I noticed the Coalition are now promising laws to change this if they win government, and you've been on about this for a long while.
I have, Chris. The whole thing is that this Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Heritage Act has been in place about over 40 years that I'm aware of. The fact is that Senator Susan Ley, she's not a senator, Susan Ley, who's the deputy leader for the opposition, she actually set the precedent for this years ago when they came to her in 21 about putting a go-kart track, and of course the Aboriginal mob then approached her about it. So she set the precedent then, and Tanya Plavisak did the same for the Blaney Mines. It's got completely out of control. Let me tell people the background to the story. Brian Grant died, so this mob went to the council to spread his ashes on Mount Panorama, or Mount Philomy. So anyway, it was agreed to do it and they allowed him. Now they're claiming it as a heritage site for cultural reasons because his ashes are there. How ridiculous is all this?
That was in 2022.
It has to stop, Chris. As I said, 2022, correct. So they got permission for the council to spread the ashes. Now they're claiming it as a heritage site.
It's got to stop.
Cultural heritage site. So it has to stop. Chris, I'm bringing in policies that, you know, no one will get treated any differently to any other Australian based on the race, colour of their skin or their religion. Everyone will be treated equally in this country. We've got over 54% of Australia is now under native title. How much more are we going to be denied access to as Australians? And I have had a gutful of it.
So, yeah, I think obviously the mob down at Mount Panorama, I'm not too sure if it's Wiradjuri or Gunungurra or well, the mob down there. Apologies if I've got that wrong, but all I know is that these things are quite important. But it would be interesting if they did that under their government, not under Australian law, for example.
Look, Pauline Hanson, sometimes I've got to agree with her, sometimes I don't. But in this instance, all Australians are created equal. Pauline is just as much an Indigenous Australian as those of Aboriginal heritage. So you remember, you've always got to remember one thing. It's not the colour of your skin. It's not who you are, you know, where you are, but it's where the legal identity is created. That's what I'm saying. It's the piece of paper that's Indigenous to Australia, not the woman, not the actual Pauline Hanson herself. Her identity, her legal identity, is an Indigenous Australian. Just like someone from Yidinji, for example, that's being seen through the Australian identity, they are Indigenous Australian. A Chinese Australian who's seen through the Australian identity is an Indigenous Australian. It's where the identity is created, and that's Indigenous.
Yes, you're part of the Australia Club. Let's just say that. And in the Australia Club, the people that created it are the ones that are in charge of it because they created it. The issue is obviously it's on somebody else's land, and the people that are wanting to assert that sovereignty, and rightfully so, They can do that, but they're using the Australian persona or Club Australia to try and do that. And Australia has been set up where you can't do that, or it can be limited in what you do there. And it's purposely done that way because the tribes are no business of Australia's. And but the tribe, in its true and correct capacity, is the owner of all businesses on its territory, whether it's Australia, US, or South Korean, or whatever it may be.
Well, remember what they said in Uluru, in the Uluru Statement from the Heart. The best constitutional minds come together that Australia could muster, they could pick out. They were put together by the Prime Minister and supported, or, you know, seconded by the leader of the opposition at the time. This is the best we can find. And they come back and said, look, you know, the Aboriginal nations were the first sovereign nations on this country, and they're still here today, and they own it pursuant to their law. They said the sovereignty of those nations is unceded, unextinguished, so it must be something there with that. These minds are saying that, and that sovereignty coexists with the sovereignty of Australia. It can't coexist without a formal agreement or treaty. That's the big thing. So Australia is second in time because it says in that statement the Aboriginal people were first in time. Now, that is very important in this matter because, Bodie, it's when you look at the Indigenous Australians, the Pauline Hansons, those from Yidinji that are seen through the legal identity, they're second in time. The identity is how you participate in a society. You're not the identity. You've got to remember that thing. That's a piece of paper created by a piece of paper. I ask everyone, where's the Commonwealth of Australia? Point to me. You show me where the Commonwealth is. Show me. And they point on the wall and say, oh, there's a map there, or there's a piece of paper hanging there called the Constitution. That's the Constitution? That's the Commonwealth of Australia. There it is. It's not the real thing. It's not the real deal. So these Indigenous Australians, of which Pauline is one, and I agree 100% with that, she is, like all other Australians, equal to the rest of the Australians that are created pursuant to Australian legislation to allow that woman to participate in the society called the Commonwealth of Australia.
Yeah, and ironically, Senator Jacinta Nepajimpa Price is one of those Indigenous Australians who's looking to, I guess, through the Elon Musk, Department of Government Efficiency, looking at making sure that there's no waste with Indigenous spending, to make sure that, in the words of Andrew Bolt, I'm sure, is that things are based not on race but on need. And so let's take a listen to this because she's in a bit of a, I think she's got some investigation into some potential misuse of government money. I'm not too sure what the situation, if it's been resolved or not, but because I don't really keep up much with that. But let's just listen to her and Andrew have a go.
A highlight of Donald Trump's speech today was when he read out a long list of stupid grants of government waste that he and Elon Musk, his chief cutter, already cut in just 6 weeks. Well, we have a senator who has been appointed a month ago by opposition leader Peter Dutton to find waste here and start cutting when they win government. Joining me is the Coalition's new Shadow Minister for Government Efficiency, Jacinta Nampajimpa Price, who is also, of course, its spokesman on Indigenous Australians. Jacinta, great to catch up with you again. How is your list of waste coming along? When are we going to see what you have in mind?
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, there is a lot to trawl through in terms of waste that the Albanese government has managed to rack up. And we're in the middle of compiling all of that information at the moment. We will get to a point where we'll be able to highlight more specifically exactly those measures of waste that we certainly want to make sure that we cut back on. But I know that we're keen to trim down in terms of the public service, making sure that we maintain the front line. And essential services. But also, I mean, I'll give you one example of a grant that was brought to my attention, which was around ensuring that scientists could be taught how to develop drag shows in order to attract the LGBTQI community into STEM. So there's no doubt going
You're
to be a raft
me.
Of those sorts of
You're
measures
me.
That... I'm not kidding you, you can't make this stuff up. That's one example, but I know that there's much more than that exists within what this government has been doing over this last term.
Have you ever considered mainstreaming Aboriginal programs, and not just for savings, but so that we give welfare on the basis of need and not race?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, this is something that I have been talking about for some time now. Within the Indigenous portfolio, I know that our direction will be, when we win government, is to ensure that we're providing support for our most marginalised, based on the fact that they're marginalised, not necessarily on their race. And look, I mean, I visited a wonderful place in Warrnambool just the other day, the Gunditjmara co-op, that are providing health services for the whole community and doing a wonderful job at that, and utilising, creating their facilities with little support from governments. But these are the sorts of things we're looking at. We're looking at funding outcomes as opposed to pouring money into organisations just because they tick an Indigenous box, because this is what the Labor approach has been. And evidently, that's not actually closing the gap. So we will be outcomes-focused, outcomes-driven, as opposed to just pouring taxpayer dollars into measures because they tick an Indigenous box. We'll be taking a different approach.
Jacinta, last night I reported on the activists identifying as Aboriginal who said they were traditional owners from the area around Bathurst and Orange, and they were the ones that somehow persuaded the Albanese government to effectively ban a gold mine, as you know. They now want the peak of Mount Panorama near Bathurst declared a significant Aboriginal heritage site because 2 years ago they scattered the ashes of one of their members there, a guy on the left of this picture who claimed to be Aboriginal. These claims are getting ridiculous. What's to be done?
Yeah. Oh, look, you know, this is what's going to happen if we continue to go down this particular direction. You can't simply, you know, hold an event or some kind and then declare a place sacred because you know, something like scattering of ashes occurred on a particular piece of land, because this could be conducted all over the place if we decided to bow down to these sorts of demands, effectively, you know, claiming all these bits of land sacred and therefore should not be accessed by the rest of the community. We will be, and we will come out with our reforms in time enough. But we will be reforming the Heritage Act, the Aboriginal Heritage Act, to ensure that we aren't going down the road of shutting off things like climbs, like the Mount Arapiles climb, like, you know, the climb in Mount Warning, significant parts of our country, because some groups want to make claims on these places, because we believe that the entire country is, you know, we shouldn't be prioritising on the basis of those who came Australia first and those who've come later. We're all Australians, we're all equal, we all belong to this country, and we need to limit these sorts of demands being put on parts of our country and ensure that all Australians get to have access to our wonderful country. Yeah, it's just, this is the approach that we're going to take. It's the common sense approach.
Thank heavens for that. Jacinta, I'm out of time, but instead of putting a question, I'll put a statement. I thought you took a gamble when you released your autobiography 3 weeks ago, Matters from the Heart, where you talk about how you battled and beat your abuse of drugs. I thought you might get some blowback from that, but I have not seen any. Congratulations. I haven't finished it because my wife stole it from me and has been secretly reading it somewhere else, not letting me. She just gave it to me for the interview so I could wave it at you. Just quickly, are you pleased with the reaction?
Oh, look, I'm incredibly pleased. I had the same sort of sense the day before it was being released. What have I gone and done? My skeletons are certainly basking in the sunshine. But, no, look, I'm pleased to have been able to shed the personal side of me, and Australians have been right behind me and incredibly supportive. So thank you, Australia.
Good on you. Jacinta, I've got to also say, you know, it is good to have the skeletons out there because no one can hold it over you for the rest of your career. So that is excellent. Jacinta Napajipa-Price, thank you so much.
So that was Andrew Bolt and Jacinta Price there talking about government efficiency. And obviously we mentioned earlier that she's under investigation for potential misuse of funds, and, you know, that might happen, may not happen, but I think it's the 14th time or thereabouts that this has occurred, and, you know, it might be 13 times that she was proven innocent, but I don't know and I don't care. But what I'm talking about and what we're talking about before is that everyone has rights and obligations inside of Australia, whether you're a black Australian, a white Australian, a Chinese Australian, a rainbow Australian, it doesn't matter. You have the same rights inside the Commonwealth of Australia, and there is no special privileges there. And that's very different from Yidinji in this case.
What you said there is right in that all Australians are created equal. Even Pauline says that. Jacinta Price being the Australian identity, absolutely right. It's an Indigenous Australian, just like Pauline, the Indigenous Australian. They're all created equal pursuant to legislation. It's a piece of paper to allow the Aboriginal woman, Jacinta, to take part in the life of Australia. Jacinta, though, different to Pauline, has the right to take part in an Aboriginal nation whose sovereignty is unceded, unextinguished, and that's acknowledged by the constitutional experts of the Uluru Statement. They came out and said that the Aboriginal people, of which Jacinta would have connection to somewhere, I think it might be the centre of Australia, the woman will have connection to country to which has not done a deal with Australia, the Commonwealth of Australia. Australia does not have the right or the necessary sovereignty to extinguish extinguish the rights of those Aboriginal nations. So if she wants to be seen through the Australian identity, she's going to be equal to Pauline Hanson. She's going to be, and I agree with what's going on. You know, inside Australia, don't waste the money. You know, that's fair enough because everyone works hard to pay tax to get things to happen. But don't confuse that with what's owing under Article 28 of the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People. Under it, look it up yourself. Give the place back. Pay them for it or give them somewhere equal. Now, how much would her country be worth if she went back to her true capacity, not as an Indigenous Australian, but as a member of her Aboriginal society whose sovereignty is unceded, unextinguished, and Australia had to pay whatever amount, and I really don't know how you'd value that. It'd be some incredible amount of money, which is worthless anyway, so Australia can't pay the bill. We know that. We've had that discussion before, going back 7 or 8 years with a number of senators. You know, how do you pay one lot? How do you pay the whole lot? They can't. So there's this issue. But remember, Jacinta, unlike Pauline, has the right to go back to her Aboriginal society, the one whose sovereignty is unceded, unextinguished. And this is very important to remember because everyone's trying to contain it all within the Commonwealth of Australia. You know, there's a number of issues. And if Jacinta's been doing the wrong thing, she deserves a slapping. If Pauline's been doing the wrong thing, she deserves a slapping. You know, you can't go and plunder the public purse inside Australia and hope to get away with it. It's really just not the right thing to do.
Yeah, I guess the most important thing is not to get the world confused, because ultimately, while they do participate in the member state that is called Australia or the Commonwealth of Australia, their physical bodies are on a tribal territory, and this is something that they can't escape. No one can. When you walk on this earth, you're on someone's country, whether you got a piece of paper or not. And that's the most important thing, because the law of the land is the be-all and end-all. It's just by design that the world of persons are there to control a majority of the planet, and fair enough, because there's 8 billion people, so identity is everything. But don't get lost in this whole, punching, robbing Peter to pay Paul and all that kind of stuff. You know, you can't use the Yidinji law to try and get out of Australian law. We were always very, very adamant about that. The same way you can't just think Australian law is above all the law, because maybe the law isn't there or someone isn't there to represent the law, for example, but it's never been ceded. So you're going to have to take care and govern yourself accordingly wherever you are, whoever you are.
And that's what does away with this sovereign citizen pseudo-law rubbish. You know, they think they can jump out of Australia, and absolutely they've got every right to jump out of Australia. You can't be forced to honour the contract. If you want to give it away, give everything away, give the cash away, give the identity, give everything back. You can't be forced to be seen through that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, and that's fair enough. Give it back. However, be careful what you jump out of, because and you jump into, because there's another first-in-time law here. you may be seen as a trespasser if you don't come within the law of the nation, the Yidinji nation, for example. Be very careful, because in that world there may be capital and corporal punishment for trespass or theft or whatever else it may be. So be very careful if you want to go down the sovereign citizen pseudo-law rubbish, you know. And that's one thing that's been said to us. The Yidinji nation, the Yidinji stuff is not pseudo-law. It's not sovereign citizen rubbish. This stuff is very legitimate, very real, and it does have standing at law. And the Uluru statement makes it very clear. It was first in time and it's continuing. The sovereignty of the Indigenous nations is here today.
You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today. Murumu and Ginyara here with you on Black Law Tribal Edition. We'll be back after the break.
Eddie on the track.
Stay awake at night, just until you fall asleep. So heavy, as long as you get me to be a part of your dream, and I'm sleeping as long as you let me. As long as you let me be a part of your dream, and I'm sleeping. Man, you got me falling.
Yeah, welcome back. Gurul Argyle is the president of Binagalbumba, the Yidinji court or tribunal, and earlier I spoke with him about the future of the Yidinji jurisdiction and what that may look like in terms of jurisprudence and court proceedings. Enjoy. Gurul, thanks for joining us. I'm just wondering now that... the Yidinji Nation moving forward has a number of institutions in place, and through some of the excellent development programs that you've overseen, the Yidinji Nation can now source mediators. But that needs to obviously be increased in time. What other exciting developments can you see and opportunities for the Yidinji Nation to provide its citizens that space for remedy and other things that come to mind?
I think, first of all, just acknowledging the local elders, I want to say that part of my work has involved assisting the state of PNG to develop its mediation service under the National and Supreme Courts there. So working with a judge in PNG who was particularly interested in ADR, he and I went to the Solomon Islands High Court to help train them in mediation, and then we worked together in PNG to bring forward that mediation system by training magistrates and judges initially, and the court and the parliament making laws and regulations in relation to mediation. To me, that kind of process could be reproduced in the Yidinji realm. And we've already kicked off in the practical sense. That is, we've conducted a number of mediation training sessions. And probably the important observation about that, even though the qualification was designed in the Australian realm, it's recognised in the Yidinji realm, and we're offering accreditation in that space. But I do want to emphasise that people who have graduated from that realm, Indigenous folk, have been able to contribute enormous value to mediating matters outside of the Yidinji territory. So the system has shown to work in PNG, it works in Australia, and it will work in the Yidinji territory. So that's one component.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Obviously, that two-way learning that Dr. Yinapingu coined that phrase many years ago is the practical approach that the Yidinji Nation is taking. And it's wonderful to have someone of your expertise and knowledge and wisdom, in fact, that is obviously appreciated by elders here to move forward in this space, because the terms of the Western system, if we can call it that, there are practical benefits, and there is some sort of international standard. Now, having Yidinji producing its own version of that is not only a challenge, but it's an exciting prospect, because we can really focus on what's working out there and have some sort of cultural application and sphere put into that model locally.
I think it's important that what we're doing is we're creating a standard here in the Yidinji Nation. So that's one point. The second point is that, yes, it does reflect international standards, and yes, and as does the Australian accreditation system. And so I don't think you can throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think you need to take some of the elements of the mainstream standard, the global standard, and bring that within the Yidinji system and use Yidinji meanings and influences to modify that stance so it's actually useful on the ground here. You can imagine that even the cultural differences between, say, France and the United States or Russia, you would have to take a different mediation approach. It's common in the mediation world to talk about the particular circumstance of Asia and how you might modify your mediation stance. So it's not a great leap, I don't think. It's fairly straightforward.
And I think we're in a good position with the leadership of the elders, because I would say there'd be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my guess would be that there would be a space for the administration or the contract law aspect of it, or citizens may want to opt in into a, let's say, what maybe people describe as an LORE type of environment, where there's a group of peers or elders in there to assist bring that potential conflict or dispute to a halt.
Yes. I guess there's, for me, there's several elements. One is LORE. Then there's a practical day-to-day space whereby people are in conflict and they need mediators, and that might involve people of different cultural backgrounds. So, for instance, in Gimoy, there is a large Papua New Guinean population, and it would seem to me to be appropriate to conduct mediation in Pidgin for that group. Similarly, in matters involving local Indigenous folk, you would need to take into consideration the meanings and kinship relations within that group. You can, so that's one aspect of how the mediation system here is being designed. We've gone with the practical first, train up some people, get some runs on the ground. The next part of the tribunal's evolution, I guess, is to formalise that space and decide which venue, for instance, a particular conflict might be best dealt with. So if it's got a very high level of LORE, it might not in fact be suitable for mediation but need to be referred back to the elders for dealing with in some formal fashion. So a dispute over a burial might be mediation or it might be law or it might be some combination.
One of the things that I think would be very, very practical, you've mentioned that already, is that, yes, Yidinji have accredited mediators have helped outside the in the other realm, but to use a baseball phrase, a pinch hitter, if there is a, let's say, a criminal matter that needs to be heard, not that we would want that at the moment, but we have to be prepared for those things, that's possibly where someone who has experience in criminal codes could interpret the Yidinji law to determine an outcome in a potential case that would be of a criminal nature.
Our recent discussions between yourself and the Attorney General, for instance, have involved the idea of, or at least canvassed my idea around bringing you know, a magistrate from the Australian system to participate in the Yidinji system, importantly to bring some rigour to the process, but also to bring some credibility. So that experience, even though it's in a different realm, is important. And in that discussion, I gave the example of in the 70s, after 1975 and Papua New Guinean independence, Australia provided magistrates who were appointed by the PNG system but were able to immediately get runs on the board to make the system functional. And in my head, that's there's a similar kind of idea here. We might need to, you know, hold a first step, which might be a gathering of people who have something to say, who've got some runs on the board in the space, who perhaps are academics and might be able to give us some higher level thought about how to set up a system. And then a next stage would be to enact a system, and that's where I see these experienced people dropping in. And then ultimately we would create our own system with its own regulations and laws and be able to develop that. I still think, and perhaps controversially, that some elements of LAW should perhaps be shared with the Australian state rather than Yidinji trying to reinvent that wheel.
Well, I think that we're talking about practical things. And while it might be the intention of a Yidinji citizen to become a magistrate, we're not there yet. So to like I said, to use that existing resource out there is important. Now, one of the ideas that we have in terms of the private international law space, which is what Yidinji is, and the extraterritorial sovereignty, the Yidinji space could also act as an international peace court to maybe provide a space, a neutral space for any potential conflict of law between UN member states, for example, or dispute resolution regarding international companies that really want to look at and support something that's a lot more, let's say, neutral, because obviously UN member states all are connected. And that may be an option in the future for tribes that do come back with their legal entities, their governments, for example, that want to not hear their own matter, for example.
I think at the moment I'm more in the camp of trying to get towards that space of there being a Yidinji International Court. Before then, I think it's achievable that we could create an international dispute resolution space. So in the same way that countries are signing up to the Singapore Convention around arbitration mediation, it might be that there's a Yidinji Convention on mediation, which invites not only countries in dispute, but Indigenous communities who might be in dispute with their country, in the sense of, not in a dingy sense, but in the sense of, say, another Australian Indigenous group who haven't asserted sovereignty but have a dispute with the state. One of the things around the Pacific at the moment is climate change adds to conflict. Indigenous communities are intimately connected to resources and country, and climate change is creating issues for them. And those conflicts can be potentially mediated on neutral ground here in Gimoi, under the auspices of an international mediation system and a Yidinji international mediation forum court.
Absolutely, and these are aspirations. Obviously, we don't want to build it tomorrow, but we'd love that if it happened. But obviously, there is a very important process.
I want to interrupt. I think what's important is that these institutions exist already. We're not inventing a new thing. The Singapore Convention exists. At the beginning of that, the comments were, it'll never work. I think the fact that these things already exist, so there's a thing we can model ourselves on, that we have witnessed the development of PNG, I think that's a very good example, because it seems analogous to me between Yidinji Nation and PNG Nation and its development pathway. So while they're aspirations, they have a realistic element to them.
Yeah, and this is what I think where Yidinji is leading that way, because it is about security of personality, security of tenure. In my view, at least, and of the nation, that this is a frictionless cross-border space where peace, order and good government is the philosophy that's expressed most sincerely here. And I wanted to take you on a little journey down the track into the future, because and these are hypothetical things, but how do you see in the future, let's say the Yidinji was to create a digital space to have some sort of, what we're talking about now, some sort of digital space to hear matters where, crypto laws and things of that nature can be very difficult because there might be a conflict of law where Party A might say, well, it was the citizen that you initiated by using our money. The citizen might say, well, that digital asset is on a server on a third party or another nation. So it can become a bit confusing there. How do you see that Yidinji making efforts to go down that space and how, using your future outlook, how could we come up with something that would maybe remedy that situation?
Well, again, it's practical. Yidinji didn't invent digital currencies. They didn't invent, other people have done it. Other countries have done it. It already exists. So the problem pre-exists the Yidinji version of it. And I think clearly there are going to be answers that other people have tried and failed, or tried and succeeded sort of, or tried and succeeded very well. And so my suggestion would be Yidinji shops around and gets the best possible model to enable it. In the digital space, going back to the previous issue, digital platforms can be very helpful in a practical sense. So if you've got a low-key legal matter, criminal matter under a certain value, perhaps AI in a digital space could enable a quick and efficient resolution that delivers justice. There's a saying among lawyers that justice delayed is justice denied, and one of the common problems across the planet is the timing, is the lack of immediacy around justice. Similarly, a mediation platform that dealt with potentially less complex matters could be important in speeding things up. These things would obviously throw out into the human space matters that came into particular conflicts. You could design it so that it did that.
And this is the challenge, obviously, that we do have, because even now, I know that the Commonwealth Secretariat is looking at these types of issues, for example. But, you know, what would that space look like? Is it Yidinji common law? Is it Rome 1, Rome 2? Is it international convention? Or is it some sort of other law that would regulate that jurisdiction, or that parties would agree to enter into that space, for example? I mean, this is a... I'm putting you on the spot here. I do apologise.
I think the method that I've seen elsewhere is there's an international convention that sets a standard, right? Through pain and suffering, the planet has come up with rules that it says are really, really important fundamentally. So the Dresden firestorm in World War II meant that the UN convention says you can't use weapons of mass destruction. And in particular, you can't design a war system that creates a city-wide inferno. It's completely illegal. So if you have a system with that in place, then your local laws can reflect those standards, keeping in mind that the standards shift. So they're gonna change. I imagine the Palestine-Israel conflict, the Ukraine-Russia conflict will lead to another series of innovation in our international laws. And in my view, I think the Yidinji nation and its legal development should reflect the best of those conversations and changes. There is an enormous problem in Australia around the high percentage of Indigenous people in the justice system. It seems completely inappropriate. There is no practical reason for that to occur. It costs money, it takes time, it occupies the police force, it occupies the judicial system. They're all practical reasons. In more human terms, it creates pain in families and in individuals that is completely unnecessary. I think that what we need to be careful about is how we design a system so that we don't have unintentional consequences. So the application of law inappropriately to a particular group results in awful consequences. People have argued that it is intentional. I don't think we need to go there. I think we just need to look at the fact and say, well, we don't want that. Let's have something else. How would we get to something else?
Yeah, and this is why we spoke earlier about, is it an LORE to opt into that space, or is it through contract law? Through the citizenship, for example, or the written law and the laws that citizens should uphold. You brought up a very, very good point there, and I wanted to sort of just quickly elaborate on that about unintended consequences. In terms of, once again, putting on your future thinking hat, how can we stop AI from being biased, or how does AI reflect cultural values of the Yidinji Nation, for example?
I was... recently involved in a conversation with an Indigenous person about a database that's used to manage mediation. And that very question was raised. How is this database ethical? Which seems like all it's doing is recording information and being used in the circumstance. However, good question. It needs to be thought about. I'm not going to go into that conversation here, but basically concepts around permission, around impact. I think... you start with design, you seek to achieve a good outcome with design, but in any design process, your aim for good needs to be measured or thought of in terms of consequence. So however ethical your original design is, if it has a significant human consequence, then perhaps you shouldn't do it. So in specifically around AI, what is it we want it to do? And what do we imagine? We must consider the consequences. How will this be applied? What are the rules and circumstances around its application? How do we retrofit or redesign to improve against consequential harms?
One of the things there is... related to that matter is data sharing. Yeah. So how that's being used, that data. Coming back to Yidinji and providing endpoints input, potential input into the register of the Yidinji Nation, for example, how do you see that operating in the future? I mean, we spoke about that earlier briefly with the Attorney General. How does Yidinji share its information about its citizens potentially or vehicles and things like that through that data sharing potential agreements, for example?
Data sharing has a particularly important practical application. So should we do it? Yes. Should we be concerned that, you know, we don't want to end up in a situation where the data that we have shared is being used against us? And so, for instance, you might think back to Nazi Germany or current, you know, North Korea or you know, some of the other more less free states using data against its citizens. So the ethical stance for me would be, how do you design against future potential authoritarian uses in your data sharing regime? Now, right now, I don't have the formula for that. But I believe there are people out there who would have considered this problem deeply, both, and one of the things I often say to people is, listen, somebody back in 1949 already thought this through somewhat, and it's in a book somewhere. And perhaps someone who's got, you know, ready that information kind of on their fingertips can be brought into the process. So the point I'm trying to make there is human experience is broad and deep. Let's use it all.
And that brings it into that particular interview with Gurit Argyle, the president of the Yidinji Tribunal. We'll be back after the break with some final comments.
Hey, Yan Yamok. My name's Aaron Peterson, actor, Aranda, Arabana Nations. I just want to let you know that you're listening to 98.7 FM BBM.
Yeah, that was very quick indeed. Ganyara, some final comments for the program?
It's probably the hardest thing for people to comprehend. The hardest thing is they are not the legal identity. When you are seen legally through that identity, you agree to have all these rights, and in return you've got all the obligations. So while you want to use it to get money, Medicare or whatever, you have all this right to get all that stuff to be looked after, but you do have the obligation of obeying all, not some, all the laws. You have the right to get Medicare, but you have the obligation to defend Australia. You got the right to use the passport, but you must not harm Australia. You've got to protect it with every ounce. But you see, it's the paper thing that you're defending. It's the paper thing that you are looking at. You aren't it. You're seen through it. Same when you go back, when you can leave Australia, but you can go back to what? To the Yidinji Nation, for example, is still here, which is why the government here for citizenship. When you become a citizen of the Yidinji Nation, all of a sudden you're bound by Yidinji law. You know, this stuff, there's rights and obligations again. And so this is very important stuff, and that's what Jacinta, I don't know if she sees this stuff, Jacinta Price. She is a woman of cultural connection to country. Pauline doesn't have a cultural connection to here. I think it's Wales. I think she's Welsh. So she's got every right to go back there and assert her Indigenous status. And there's no two ways about that. This stuff applies globally, you know, this Indigenous rights. Go and read the document. Go and read UNDRIP. Why would they actually write that document? Is that a national suicide document of the world, or is there something to it? Because remember with UNDRIP, four nations outright refused to accept it. The US, Canada, New Zealand and Australia. And within 2 years, Australia accepted it. All the rest of all accepted it as well. But Australia said, yeah, we'll support that document. They didn't have to. But when you start to read the document, it says there's us and there's them. There's two different worlds there, but everyone wants to be in the them. They all want to be in the state. You know, we've got every right to go back to our world and revitalise our stuff, bring it back to life. And that brings me to a matter with the Fortescue group, Twiggy Forrest. Now, there's an argument going on inside the courts that the West Australian government and Fortescue owe $1.8 billion to the local mob over there. But who are they going to pay that to? Are they going to pay that to the Indigenous Australians, or are they going to pay it to the original mob in their correct standing? And if they pay it to the Indigenous Australians, it's wrong. The Indigenous Australians shouldn't be getting the money. That, if you read Article 28 of UNDRIP, either give them back their place, give them somewhere equal or pay them. But they make it very clear in UNDRIP that the Indigenous nation is not the state. Two different things there. And if you want to be seen through the identity of the state, you're not entitled to that money. That's where it's got to go back to the original mob, whose sovereignty is unceded, unextinguished. And if you're being seen through the legal identity of Australia, this is so important. If you're being seen through their identity, you have no right. You have no right to participate in that money stuff of the Aboriginal nation. You've got to go and create your world, which you can do, revitalise all the institutions, and come back to life. Be here. Be here first in time, continuing. Ensure that you're seen legally and politically through your identity.
Yeah, there might be provisions in the Australian law that allow that $1.8 billion to be paid to a group of Australians that, well, legitimately. We don't know. But ultimately, any form of settlement from a Yidinji point of view would have to be in Yidinji dollars and not Australian dollars. Am I correct in saying that?
No, absolutely right, because Australian dollars make the Australian law. That's what gives the law the validity. You believe their gammon money is not gammon anymore. You believe their paper money has some value, so you want that. And that's the thing I tell everyone. You know, it's only just paper. It's all just gammon. What is the money? You tell me what the money is. You know, it's just $10, $20, $50. What is that? So, you know, it's our dollars. It's our currency. It's our stuff. So this is the difference. Coexisting sovereignties, and that's where the money is created, in coexisting sovereignties.
That brings an end to the show today. We'll be back next week with some other news and interviews, and I guess, and with a full bench. And thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week. Gaia Baragala Nunda, may God's peace be upon you wherever you are listening to the show. In the Almighty name of Yeshua HaMashiach. For it is written, He is the way, the truth, and the life. And we'll catch you next week. Galing. Sometimes